E.O. Wilson is an inspiration, and I think I understand why. Recently, having had two children, one now four and one year old, I had the pleasure of being in the countryside with them, and the pleasure of being in the countryside not only with my children, but also with E.O. Wilson's book, The Creation. And there's one chapter which I particularly liked. It's chapter 15, How to Raise a Naturalist. And if you don't mind, I will read a few lines from it. The ascent to nature begins in childhood, and the science of biology is therefore ideally introduced in the earliest years. Every child is a beginning explorer naturalist, hunter, gatherer, scout, treasure seeker, geographer, discoverer of new worlds, all these are present at the child's inner core, rudimentary perhaps, but straining for expression. Through time immemorial, children were reared in intimate contact with natural environments. The survival of their tribe depended on a close, tactile knowledge of wild plants and animals. And I think E.O. Wilson might tell us why we need to have a tactile inebriation with nature, why it is so important, and why our artificial environment, as it were now, is creating great havoc in our childhoods and in our later years. So E.O. Wilson will be introduced properly by his editor, Bob Weil.
Thank you, Paul. I am Bob Weil. I am an executive editor at Norton. I also have the great privilege of being Ed Wilson's editor. This book is an appeal on many levels. This is an appeal for a boy as young as William Brockett sitting in the first row to become a naturalist. This book is an appeal to save the environment. This book is an appeal for a political union of sorts. We seem hopelessly mired in a war of cultures. A recent New York Times article, I think it was about a month ago, pointed out that the country's divide between red and blue states, hawks and liberals, is more acrimonious now than it was even during the Vietnam War. So many of us, especially in places like New York and Ed Wilson's adopted city of Boston, grow so despondent about the trajectory of the nation. What is going on? There seems no hope of any sort of rapprochement between warring groups, and that a growing succession of ideas, a boiling fundamentalism on both sides, if we have the courage to look at ourselves, threaten to undo this very fragile cultural union. So intense seems this divide that not a few people, when they learn of the premise of Ed's new book, The Creation, they scoff. And they don't even want to look at this book. And they say, why should I look at a book which speaks to evangelicals, to ministers, to many on the presumed right, assuming that all ministers and Christian evangelicals are on the right of the political spectrum? But Wilson, a man who comes from Alabama, who, as a young man, as he writes in his book, took the waters, has never been afraid to take risks, to buck popular opinion, to make public statements that at first might seem vexing and controversial. While other leading scientists, pundits, writers seem eager to stoke our great national bonfire that's going on right now, that to fuel the conflagration that seems so shredded the American culture in two, Wilson, very surprisingly, seems to have totally changed directions. His new book appears like a departure for a man never known for ecumenical philosophy or pacifying wisdom. But if anything, The Creation could be his most revolutionary book. a book that attempts to build a bridge, a meeting, as Paul Wood remarked on, between scientists and evangelicals, a book that challenges the rhetoric and hate which is going on right now. We can only hope, then, that this book, with its consideration and reason, coming at this troubled time, will be a harbinger of things to come. One never knows as a book editor. May the creation force us not only to work and appeal to save the environment, whose existence is more imperiled than all of us think, and lead us out of a state of profound denial, but lead us to speak out with less derision for the other side. Perhaps the creation can even serve as a building block, providing a semblance of unity where none has been thought to exist in the past, that we might be willing, as Wilson writes, quote, to meet on the near side of metaphysics in order to deal with the real world we share. Thank you to all of you, and this is to introduce Ira Flatow and Professor Ed Wilson.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob, for that introduction. I'm Ira Flatow, that's Ed Wilson. I knew they'd get us mixed up, didn't you? The first time I actually met Dr. Wilson was at a science meeting about 30 years ago, in which a pitcher of cold ice water at a lectern was dumped on top of his head as he was giving a talk. And I can't think of a better way to begin than to you tell everybody what happened and why you were so well anointed that evening.
No, I claim the historical distinction of being the only living scientist to be attacked for an idea. And the idea was that of sociobiology. In 1975, I published a book called Sociobiology, the New Synthesis. And in it, I devoted page after page of this book, which was, you know, meant to be my magnum opus. That's defined as a book heavy enough so that if dropped from a three-story house can kill a man. But I went on and on, chapter after chapter, with glorious illustrations drawn with great accuracy by Sarah Landry, a fine scientific illustrator. On social animals, all kinds. I went from one end to the other. And that got a lot of favorable attention and critical review, because no one had ever done it quite that way before. But then I said, you know, I can't leave this book without writing about the big Quijano. The mammal, you know, us. And so I had to write about humans, and I then took that opportunity to address the human condition and human social behavior with the same ideas and concepts that had been developed for the rest of the world. And I thought it was a rather nice piece of pablum that would introduce ideas that they hadn't heard of before to the social sciences, and that all would be well, but it was not to be, because I'd run up against the blank slate culture. That's the culture that prevailed in the 70s, not just on the left, where it was doctrine, neo-Marxist doctrine then, but also throughout the social sciences, namely, that the mind is built as a product of culture and experience and contingency on a brain that is essentially a blank slate. Now, all the evidence pointed against that at the time, and I thought it was perfectly ordinary, maybe it would be even orthodox, to describe some of the traits of human nature that we'd begun to understand, could understand better with sociobiology. Well, a storm hit. At total unexpected, to my dismay and to the delight of Harvard University Press, and so it raged through the 70s as what was called the biggest intellectual controversy of the day. And if you ask students entering biology now, even graduate students in biology, about the sociobiology controversy, today, they would, a large percentage, maybe a majority would say, well, I haven't heard of that, or I've heard of it, but I don't know what it was all about, and so on. The blank slate died as an idea 25, 30 years ago. But, and I'm being very long-winded about this because I'm trying to build up my courage for this evening. There was a radical group there.
One of those Science for the People.
It was Science for the People.
Actually,
it was International Committee Against Racism. And they had bought the idea from some of the blank slate people that not only was this a wrong idea, but that it was politically dangerous, because if you allow for instinct in human beings, if you allow for a genetic basis of human behavior, it's not just culture, mm-hmm. not just experience. And then if you allow for that, if you follow the tortured logic up to this point, that means you would allow for genetic differences between people in personality, intelligence, and so on. Of course, all of that was textbook stuff in the 70s already, and in books on human genetics and behavior and so on. But that's what incensed them, and they wanted to set an example by dousing a scientist, and they took over the stage and dumped the water on me, and then while I was drying myself off, proclaimed the goals of the new world.
They said you were all wet, Dr. Wilson.
Yeah, they did.
Something like that.
I was too.
You've said to me that things prevail, new ideas prevail because. Or they don't prevail because they outlive their critics.
Critics. I was quoting Niels Bohr.
Right.
That was earlier in our conversation before.
Is this one? Was this that kind of idea that prevailed? Because you've outlived your critics.
Oh, yes, I have. Yes. Paul Samuelson said, "Funeral by funeral, theory advances." He said it. I didn't.
But you wish I had said it.
But Niels Bohr said, frankly, that his theory, the atom right. theory and so on, which all these things are in hot dispute, scientists are among, you don't see it, but scientists are among the most combative people outside of the African spotted hyena. Bohr did say that the reason why the atom theory, which every textbook ever studied by anybody doing physical sciences, was succeeded because he outlived his critics.
Right. Well, do you think this is the book, The Creation, is another rabble rousing? Book like
the opposite, Ira.
Tell me about it.
It is meant to bring peace, and my my real deep goal. It's not the only one, and all the others is not a pretext. But the real goal is saving the creation. And it dawned on me that saving the creation, saving biodiversity, is a rather complicated business. That it's an idea that you can't easily get your mind around it. Not very many people are going to get worked up and contribute to the World Wildlife Fund because a species of parrot dies in the upper Amazon. They understand climate change. I've seen it, 85% of Americans now accept that climate change is happening. It's a serious problem. It is opposed only by a small number of experts like Rush Limbaugh. There's not much of a consciousness about what I consider the problem that will matter the most to people 100 years from now and 1,000 years from now, namely that we are pauperizing the Earth in an irreversible way. The ecosystems are being wiped out, can never be reconstituted. Species are being lost at an accelerating rate, and that's well documented. And that's what I've spent a lifetime studying. This is the concern primarily of a small, proportionate to the huge American and world population, a quite small number of people who are devoted conservationists and conservation scientists and professionals and real hardcore environmentalists in our midst, and they're doing a wonderful job as best they can, but they only represent a very small percentage of the public. I think my colleagues keep thinking that maybe one more book, you know, like General Haig, the Verdun, one more charge, one more battalion of men and we'll break through, one more charge. Right. And it hasn't been happening. The atmosphere has been changing very well. Americans are becoming green. Generally. So, but it occurred to me that there is one enormous group of people in this country that really should probably do, if you ask them, care about the creation. And that, of course, is the great, well, I started to say Christians, Judeo-Christian, and why not just say those of the Abrahamic religions, including Islam. They care. But they don't have it articulated, and furthermore, they just don't see the need to really move on this one now. If they could be recruited, even right. a tiny fraction could be recruited, then it could tip the balance. This could be a tipping point. Well, that was my dream, and so we shall see what happens.
Now, and you start your book out, and the book is basically a long, it starts out the first chapter, Letter to a Southern Baptist Pastor.
Yeah.
Why did you pick a Southern Baptist pastor?
I grew up a Southern Baptist pastor. I've wandered a bit, but
so you felt safe in that.
You know, if let me say that if I had been a young fellow of the Jewish persuasion from Brooklyn,
you're looking at me when you say that. Which is exactly right.
I want you to join us at the river. But the point is that somehow this would have been created a little bit of a disjunction in the original thing.
Yeah.
But to come, that's why I selected evangelicals. I also selected evangelicals because of what I call the New York effect. And that is, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. If you can make it with the with the evangelicals, you know, the fundamentalists included, you can make it with the rest of the religious community.
Well, to give our audience a flavor of the kind of, it's a terrific book, I'm going to ask you to read the first page and a half.
Dear pastor, we have not yet met. Yet I feel I know you well enough to call you friend. First of all, we grew up in the same faith. As a boy, I answered the altar call. I went under the water. Although I no longer belong to that faith, I am confident that if we met and spoke privately of our deepest beliefs, it would be in a spirit of mutual respect and goodwill. I know we share many precepts of moral behavior. Perhaps it also matters that we are both Americans, and insofar as it might still affect civility and good manners, we are both Southerners. Passé, New Yorkers. I write.
I didn't see that in that book. Well, editing as you go. You're right.
I wanted to keep goodwill here. I write to you now for your counsel and help. Of course, in doing so, I see no way to avoid the fundamental differences in our respective worldviews. You are a literalist interpreter of Christian Holy Scripture. You reject the conclusion of science that mankind evolved from lower forms. You believe that each person's soul is immortal, making this planet a way station to a second eternal life. Salvation is assured those who are redeemed in Christ. I am a secular humanist. I think existence is what we make of it as individuals. There is no guarantee of life after death, and heaven and hell are what we create for ourselves on this planet. There is no other home. Humanity originated here by evolution from lower forms over millions of years, and yes, I will speak plain, our ancestors were ape-like animals. The human species has adapted physically and mentally to life on Earth and no place else. Ethics is the code of behavior we share on the basis of reason, law, honor, and an inborn sense of decency, even as some ascribe it to God's will. For you, the glory of unseen divinity. For me, the glory of the universe revealed at last. For you, the belief in God made flesh to save mankind. For me, the belief in Promethean fire seized to set men free. You have found your final truth. I am searching. I may be wrong. You may be wrong. We may be both partly right.
Very good. Thank you. Does this say that there is room for compromise? Do you think that it's going to take compromise on both sides?
There is no room for compromise. Let's be perfectly clear about that. It's my view that the gap between the two worldviews is wider than it's ever been. It's widened all the time by the growth and the compelling nature of scientific evidence. Mm-hmm. It would be foolish in my perception to try to paper that over. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't stop us. Americans, in particular, have always gotten along with radically different views and achieved great things together. Why should we have to have some sort of compromise in our metaphysical views before we got busy and did something?
So we can agree to disagree, but we have to save the planet as the goal.
Yeah, that's right. I think I'm the first to actually take this approach. And I believe that the reason is, for taxonomy's sake.
Of course.
I like to divide the scientists who have, the ones who come mainly from science, who have addressed the issue of the relation between science and religion, into two groups. They are the warriors and the wimps. And the warriors include Dan Dennett and Richard Dawkins. And they believe that the way to settle a science and religion dispute is the way a Vietnam general in the Air Force once said, we could win the Vietnam War. Bomb them until you see the rubble bounce. And that's what a lot of their books are. They're just, Sam Harris, who will be coming here shortly, I think takes that approach. It's all foolishness. It's all delusion. The point is you just slam it and expose it until finally it just goes away. That is based on a massive misunderstanding of human nature and of the deep roots and fundamental role of religion in society.
Do you think that there is any room for addressing creation in the classroom? I mean, is it not a teaching opportunity in a science class? I play devil's advocate, because so I think there's something to this, that if a student asks, why not God, then you can show it, you can show how there are questions that science can answer and questions that science can't answer.
I don't think there's any place for it. And I think it would be actually dangerous to science to religion to so intrude it. If you were to try to pull religion into science, it's going to get badly bruised. And if you do that in the presence of students, it could be lethal. But there's another reason why this is dangerous for the fundamentalists. We want to close out or bring it in, intelligent design. And that is, it's sort of based upon an assumption, sometimes made it explicit, that scientists are in a kind of conspiracy to try to prevent intelligent design from being brought into the classroom, that we fear it. My goodness, nothing could be farther from the truth. See, the problem with intelligent design is that it, besides it, there's not a shred of evidence. But there's not even a theory, as one physicist once famously said about one of his more modestly endowed colleagues, who he said of his theory, why, it's not even wrong. In other words, they can't even imagine how you go from a supernatural outside nature force in and transcribe that into the physical processes of random mutations and so on. It hasn't even been faced. It hasn't even been imagined, dreamed of. And let me assure you that if someone did it and actually came up with a testable idea, it would be regarded as potentially the most important scientific discovery in history, and there would be a stampede of scientists to get in on that, because the business of science, its currency, its gold and its silver, discoveries. If you make a discovery, then you're a scientist. You make a great discovery, you're a great scientist. You can be a complete jerk after that, and you're still, you'll never be taken away from it. You're always going to be a scientist, you're a great scientist.
Know a few of those. I know a few, I'm sure you want more than I do.
I will not accept present, your naming names. Right.
Present
anyway,
company excluded.
I've gone too long, but I thought this was a very
just as you laid it out, could it not be discussed this way in science class? Just read what E.O. Wilson has written about this, as a way of discussing it.
Yeah, but
in
I
science.
Think most science teachers in this country would want to bring it in as to show the students how not to think about science, talk about science, or not to to think of as science.
Right.
The way I did it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. You know, you have this quiet demeanor about you, doesn't he? It's very quiet, but you're underneath here. See, he's looking at me like there's this volcano waiting for the right button to be pushed, right?
Yeah.
You know, you get pretty upset about things.
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic.
I can see that.
I'm tired of going down to the tropics where I started my career and, seeing yet one more area of rainforest clear cut for...
Yeah.
For palm oil trees or for soybean.
It's getting old.
Because I know what's being lost.
You have that unique perspective because you go down there and actually watch.
I've watched it unfold over the last 50 years. And I have colleagues who followed it for decades who tell me that in what we call the hot spots of biodiversity, of these places, there's been a major wiping out.
How do you stop the rainforest destruction? Is there anything that you can
do? A lot's been tried, and we made real strides in the 1992 Rio conference. Awareness certainly has risen dramatically around the world, and actual research programs have been instituted in many of the developing countries and strengthened here. New parks have been created, and this is especially welcome in countries like Gabon and Madagascar, where there was a risk of the whole thing just going to zero.
This is not on the radar screen in this country, is it?
Yeah, compared to the total global picture,
yeah,
it's not a lot, and you're right, it's not on the radar screen. We really need to have this somehow get into the media, but that's
a whole other story.
Well, no, I was about to say, that's your job.
That's my job. I got to put on my junior media man button to do that. I could talk for hours about the media. Don't get me started.
I'm not laying this on you. You're terrific.
Thanks.
Media generally have not handled this domain of human concern very felicitously.
Right.
And science generally. But that's another subject.
That's
another evening. Reporting and science and media.
Get me started. Now, let me ask you about this Pluto thing.
Yeah.
You know, here we are in a city that is so far ahead, the city that doesn't sleep, that already has the Rose Center, already took Pluto out of there years ago.
Yeah.
You know? What do you think of, was this a tempest in a teapot, or you think this is something that's important?
Well, after thinking about it a great deal, I think it's a tempest in a teapot. Actually it is, obviously. This is an example of something that's hard for us to let go of. I mean, how many of you had to memorize the planets and the solar system? You know? You had that under your belt. I mean, that just rattled right off. And then the word was that we were going to add three more planets. You remember
right,
that?
Right.
Ceres.
Yes.
I forgot the other two already.
Zena. Ceres. What? Zena was one.
Zena.
Right. Ceres.
Yeah, then comes the news that no, they're going to get demoted, or at least Pluto, poor little Pluto, demoted to a dwarf planet. And you know that's good science. Get used to it.